maybe 2 years ago when I stood in line after a service shaking the hand of a woman I hadn't yet met. She was shaking from head to toe, and out through her fingers she held my hand, but the rest of her body was already beyond me, urging herself toward those front doors. When I asked her to wait, "What is your name? What has brought you here today?" she looked me in the eyes and she said, "Do you know what it took for me to get over that bridge this morning? Do you know how many years it has been since I've been able to cross that bridge and see this place? You say you're this and that kind of loving community, this and that kind of doing good in the world, but what about for those of us whose lives were ruined because of this place? Because of Peter Jenkins?" It has been a year since the Me Too movement swept our country. Created in 2007 by Tanara Burke in an effort for young women of color to hear that the pervasiveness of sexual harassment and assault was neither an individual experience nor something to be ashamed of. It was a statement, in Burke's words, from survivor to say, "I see you, I hear you, I understand you, and I am here for you. I get it." And get it we did. And call forth a movement it did, first by the disruption of one voice laying claim to her reality, and then another, and another, echoing a chorus of voices higher than usually heard, clanging from space to space like sound does from the bottom of a canyon and pinging up to the skies. Disruption is the only and right word. It is audacious for any woman to disrupt the ease through which a powerful man moves through the world. In Hollywood, in newsrooms, on the political right and the political left, for decades, for a lifetime, creating systems around him, instilling norms and new laws, or just laws that are truer than that which is written, laws for centuries, it seems. But disruption also because it was not just one powerful man, not just one type of man, but also men who, onto whom we put the symbol of our trust and our values. Men in sweater vests and university sweatshirts and children's dessert ads, all mixed in our minds with drugs and intentional, systematic, repetitive assault. And disruption also because as the echoes got stronger, louder, layered, like orchestral instruments warming up before the silence, before the instruction, before that collective song, it was disruptive to the women and girls who had come to realize that our silence hasn't always or necessarily been bred out of fear, but out of the understanding that this is the way the world treats those of us who inhabit the female body. Me too, of course. I want to pause and say here, acknowledge that throughout this morning, I am speaking in gender binary terms, men and women. There are men who are victims of harassment and violence, especially gay, bisexual, and gender nonconforming men. There are women who are perpetrators of violence. Each of us has the ability to misuse power. Today, I am saying men and women because today I need to speak of misogyny and patriarchy, which affects all of us in many ways and overwhelmingly in terms of the gender-based violence of men against women. Peter Jenkins, the man who that visitor shook because of, was the third settled minister of this congregation. He is the reason we are and will always be referred to as an after-pastor church. He is the cause for deep wounds among families in this space who are not part of some distant past, but who are still very much among us. And he is not a unique mark on our history, but an example of power abused, of some brazen and believed assumption that his behaviors would not be disrupted. It is estimated that nearly 70%, not of religious institutions, this is not a sermon on the Catholic Church, but 70% of Unitarian Universalist congregations have a history of misconduct or abuse by their ministers. And some experts believe it may be higher. Stories are still surfacing decades later, which we now know disqualifies the truth and ramifications of the experience if ever we were to think otherwise. Perhaps this period of our history deserves more time today. We have given it more time in the past. We will give it more time in the future. But I will just say, I don't have it within me today to speak to that place on the spectrum of why, 1 year later, the echoes of Me Too still require a courage that is neither proud nor popular. I was walking back to a friend's house the other day through this beautiful preserve in Hopewell, filled with gratitude for the sky and openness and fireflies and everything amazing about living in a place like this. When I passed a man on the path, it was 6 p.m., still light out. I had sneakers on. I knew to think that I had sneakers on, and still my heart rate began to rise. Now, if you've been in any situation in which your heart rate rises for whatever reason, you know it's not just your heart rate. What a funny phrase. But rather, it is through the palms of your hand and in your throat and out through every morsel of your body. I think of myself as a rational person and a privileged woman who does not hold the acute trauma of rape or violent assault in my bones, but still my heart rate began to rise. Do I look him in the eyes? Don't I? What am I communicating? Do I want to invite some moment of connection? Do I want him to think, to know I'm afraid? Kim, you don't need to be afraid. Don't be ridiculous, I tell myself. And then we pass each other. And of course, I have, like you, have passed countless men in countless situations and have never been harmed. But do you know what I thought next? Should I turn around and see if he's still walking? Should I turn around and see if he has stopped? Comedian Hannah Gatsby says in a recent prolific performance, "I do not hate men, but I am afraid of them." I am deeply uncomfortable with speaking any of these words from this pulpit today. Misogyny, patriarchy, fear, those are hard, but the truth is there will be many more I choose not to speak, and that is far harder. Those other words fill my head and heart and body, clanging on the spirit's cage with want to be heard, but there are rules about conversations like this. I learned very early on that my job as minister is to be a neutral mouth from which you could receive a good and uncomplicated word. I won't forget the day I was told by another congregation not to speak of Tara, not to mention being gay, because I had to be everyone's minister. Obama was everyone's president, was actually the helpful advice I received that day. You see, there are rules. And they are taught, offered easily for some of us who are outside of those you expect to hold power and points of privilege, rules that keep truths quiet and personhood small. It was also that time of my career in which I learned a woman adorned in lipstick gets 7 to 11 more seconds of being heard. You know, because we aren't used to paying attention when a woman speaks. It wasn't really until I came to this congregation, until I served here, that I began to bravely, daringly speak of Tara's name again from a pulpit. And yet still, always, with lipstick. And so I say again, it is deeply uncomfortable for me to say to and in front of the men of this congregation, whom I care about, a word that is neither good nor comfortable. The women among you no matter our position or rank, no matter if we are your daughter, your wife, your friend, or your minister, we are each part of a legacy. A legacy that is larger than the fear that explicit violence may one day meet us, or a reminder that it already has and could again, though there is this legacy, this real and embodied and constant truth. But it is also a legacy of acceptance, an expectation that quiet, small dismissals, girl, babe, chick, nasty, must we break down the words for catcall, must we discuss, and forgive me for saying it from this pulpit, that the word bitch is not a value-neutral synonym for complain. And the overt propositions, nonchalant questions and comments about our bodies, our capabilities, our reproduction, its function, our choices, our sexual orientation, these we know will happen every single day. It is the same legacy that determines our worth by the extent to which we are usable by and acceptable to men. Don't be too fat, too skinny, too emotional, too unapproachable. Don't be angry, domineering. Be sexy, but not too sexy. Best not to be butch. It is important to smile. And all of this, some perfect display of dress up and performance, when accomplished just right, the ickiest part about all of this for me is that it feels good. It feels good to feel liked. To believe we've accomplished some strange goal set before us before birth. And this then serves to muddy the waters between what actually feels good and the urge to build a life made up of that drug of wanting to please. It is the same legacy in which our friends, our neighbors, our fathers, our bus drivers, our teachers, our ministers, the people who we would call ours, it is a legacy of knowing that we could be theirs at any moment's time. This is our legacy, not because we watched some after-school special or because someone once told us to be mindful of strangers, but because these are the stories we carry with us on our skin and in our DNA, in family secrets and the relationships we choose. This is our legacy born in these bodies, not of our choosing nor ashamed of our fate. This is our legacy, no matter your gender, because it is a legacy of resignation to a norm that is both overt and implicit, which is a legacy of abuse. And while you may disagree, while you may sit in surprise that causes you want to debate, to dismiss, to offer up not all men, not mine, not my husband, my boys, my brothers, my friends, me in the mirror, I offer that this is the same response that whiteness retorts to the realities of white supremacy, to the waters of racism which we cannot always see or name nor extricate ourselves from. These are long, deep, entrenched stories and behaviors, and while we who are bred for individualism and power may not like the suggestion that something was determined before our birth that decided our power and privilege, that again, as we have stated and prayed for more than 4 years in this space, does not mean we are atoned from the work to change the truths before us. Truths that are neither inherent nor fixed, but made and secured each day by our alertness to the world and the choices that follow. None of us in this room is innocent, and my deep discomfort with saying that out loud, especially to a room of men I respect and care for, is the best example of this. Last week, four of us on staff, yes, all women, began speaking of the recent Supreme Court hearings. Did you see the meme, one of the women asked, that said, "Women, what would you do if you knew every man had a 9 p.m. curfew?" I want to be really clear. I'm not saying every man should be locked away by 9 p.m. at night. that every man is dangerous, that no man can control himself, or that no man has ever chosen right behavior, or even that women don't replicate some of these behaviors too. But to hear the four of us, professional, adult women, speak of what it would be like to go for a walk, to go for a run, to try to, but the impossibility of trying to imagine what it would be like to go camping by ourselves if ever we felt it was safe enough to do so. Is my heart ridiculous for racing in the presence of an unknown man at night on a somewhat secluded walk? Or is it ridiculous that it takes questions of curfews to teach us how thick, how alive, how constant and real the collective trauma of this time is for every woman everywhere? It wasn't long ago that a study came out suggesting that trauma can be passed down through our genes. Depression and anxiety, like good silver and family lore. Women, we must be as gentle and forgiving with ourselves these days as we are fierce in the world. The expectation to be kind, to be warm, to be approachable, to be happy, has too often been used as a weapon against us. These can be the tools for our own spirits now, kindness to our souls that draws out our voices out into the public, lipstick or not, warmth in finding kindred spirits with whom we may rage and shake and laugh too, approachable for our skill, insight, and wisdom that age does not erase nor deem us illegitimate, and happy in our personhood, which we will not fear, nor be ashamed of, nor hide away. For we are the place where life is made, and for too long we have watched systems of oppression, dismissal, and patriarchy tear away at what we have built. This we will do not only for our own lives, but for the generations to come, whose blood, spirit, and health will learn from our bodies, how our bodies disrupt the assumption and the expectation of resignation. It's 12 o'clock, so that means I need to stop. But I will stay in the sanctuary after the service is done, and if anyone wishes for a word of blessing, I will be here with our communal water that was made out of community and joy and the promise of seeing each other where we are, for our pain and for our work and for our healing. May we each feel the echo of one another in our bravery, for we are not alone. Blessings to each of you, and blessings especially for those of us who have bridges between our pain and where we once knew as home. Amen.